Right. All right, so we continue with lecture 11. Today's lecture will be the last lecture in the mathematics section. And it will be a little unusual, as you will see about a third way through it, because I will change to a different style. So remember, the non-trivial shape of a manifold reveals itself in several different ways. For example, the sum of the angles in a triangle will not add up to 180 degrees in general. Pythagoras' law will not hold even if one of the angles is 90 degrees, and so on. There are, in fact, different theories of quantum gravity built on those observations. For example, there is a branch of quantum gravity, dynamical triangulations, which is based on the idea that the violation of the angle sum law, 180 degrees, expresses curvature. And the difference from 180 degrees, which is called the deficit angle, can be used as a dynamical variable to describe the curvature of a space-time. And then we can try to quantize that representation of the curvature of space-time, or the shape of the space-time. The fact that Pythagoras' law is violated is used in the metric description of the shape of a space-time, and of course there are attempts to quantize this way. The non-trivial shape of a space-time can also, or of a manifold in general, can also be encoded in the affine connection, in the non-triviality of the parallel transport, and there are procedures to quantize space-time based on that idea. Now, what these descriptions, especially let's focus on the metric and the affine connection description, what they have in common is, unfortunately, that they contain a lot of redundant information, so-called gauge degrees of freedom. And they are a nuisance when you do classical general relativity, but they become a real problem if you want to do the quantum theory of general relativity. And that's because if in your theory some degrees of freedom are real, are physical, they describe something out there in nature, and some other degrees of freedom merely describe something like your choice of coordinates or choice of bases, then you really need to distinguish the two very cleanly from each other, because quantum theory should apply only to the physical degrees of freedom. You shouldn't quantize your choice of coordinate system. Right? You should quantize space-time, not something that humans make. And it is, in general, pretty tough to distinguish those two degrees of freedom, the real physical ones and the other degrees of freedom that are just pseudo-degrees of freedom that come about from our choices of, let's say, coordinate systems. So these other degrees of freedom are redundant information. Let's look at it more precisely. Two Riemannian or pseudo-Riemannian manifolds, so remember the difference is positive definite metric or not positive definite metric. So two Riemannian or pseudo-Riemannian manifolds based on the same differentiable manifold, but with two different metric tensors, must be considered equivalent in the sense of physics, must be considered physically equivalent if they describe the same space-time. Which is to say that if there exists an isometric, that is metric-preserving isomorphism between the two. So if you describe your manifold, your curved space, as a differentiable manifold with a certain metric on it, and you have another description of the differentiable manifold now with a different metric on it, but there is an isometry between the two, which in fact maps the metrics into each other, then they really describe the same curved space, the same physics. I will get to this in more detail in a moment. For now, let's clarify what we mean by metric preserving isomorphism. So an diffeomorphism. A diffeomorphism is just a differentiable map from the manifold into the differentiable manifold again. It's got to be differentiable infinitely many times, and also we want it to be invertible. But on top of that, we are now requiring that it takes this metric into that metric. In what sense is it doing that? Remember this picture. We had a manifold here, we had a manifold over there, and there was a diffeomorphism between the two manifolds. As a special case, this might be the same manifold as that. So the diffeomorphism is really going from the manifold into itself. Doesn't have to. So let's just keep the picture general for the purpose of this little picture here. So we have a manifold, a diffeomorphism in between them. And then remember that if you have a diffeomorphism between the two manifolds, that automatically induces a map between functions on this manifold and functions in that manifold. Every function on this manifold can be viewed as a function on that manifold simply by concatenating with the diffeomorphism. So that instead of taking its arguments here, it will take its arguments there, and they are then transported over there with the diffeomorphism. This, if you remember, induces also a map between the tangent spaces and the cotangent spaces and all the tensor spaces. There's going to be an isomorphism between the tangent spaces, the cotangent spaces, and general tensor spaces because of that diffeomorphism. So here, we have a diffeomorphism of the manifold into itself, and that induces a map from the space of two tensors, of covariant two tensors, into the space of covariant two tensors. And what we require in order to say that this is an isometry is that under this map, the metric goes into itself. The metric goes into the value of the metric at that other point. In that situation, we can interpret the diffeomorphism as being merely a change of coordinates. So imagine you have this manifold, it has curvature, and instead of looking at it in one coordinate system, you look at it in another coordinate system. So for example, somebody might give you a differentiable manifold and say, here's a metric tensor on it, g mu nu of x. And that person is giving you an explicit matrix-valued function g mu nu of x on that manifold. That will give that manifold its curvature, its shape. And then somebody else comes along and gives you for the same manifold another g mu nu of x, which is a different matrix-valued function. It could be that the two g mu nu of x's, the g mu nu of x and the g prime mu nu of x, describe actually the same shaped manifold, just with a different in a different coordinate system. So here is how that looks like mathematically. Let's say we have a diffeomorphism of the manifold into itself. Here's our manifold. And the diffeomorphism phi is mapping points into points. Let's say it maps the point A into the point B. Here's the diffeomorphism phi. Okay? And let's say we stay in one chart. So here we have the manifold, and the chart is mapping the manifold into a part of Rn. So in particular, this point is mapped into this point in Rn, and that point is mapped into that point in Rn. So we have one chart, and the chart map is R. R maps all those points into all these points. So R provides a coordinate system for our manifold. Let's say it covers all of the manifold, just to keep things simple. Okay, so this is one way of looking at it. We have a diffeomorphism inside the manifold. It maps points into points, and therefore in the chart, it maps names of points into names of points. But this is equivalent. You see, this is an active point of view. Here we are mapping points into other points in the manifold. But there is also a passive point of view. I'm sure you know all of that from Minkowski space, active and passive, but it works also for manifolds. So here's an equivalent way. Oh, let me show you both at once. Here's an equivalent thing. instead of saying that we have one chart, R, that maps the manifold into Rn, we can also say that we are changing chart here. Instead of doing an active transformation that maps points A into points B, we can say, no, no, we stick to the same point always in the manifold, but we change chart. Namely, we now say that the point A, which used to have under the chart R as coordinates this point here in Rn, we can now say, okay, we give A another set of coordinates, namely under the map that takes us this way to that point, same point over here, where the new chart is simply obtained by concatenating our diffeomorphism with R. So the new chart is R after phi. So we can either view this actively as a map, and it's only one, a map of the manifold into itself, and we have one chart, or we can say we have two charts, and we're just looking at one point in the manifold and two pictures under a chart. And vice versa, if we start out with the change of chart, so we have a point S here in the manifold, and we look at it under two charts, one coordinate system alpha, one chart maps it into this point in Rn, and another chart maps it into that point in Rn, then there is a change of chart map nu here, which maps Rn into Rn, which maps the coordinates of our point S, which is this point in Rn, into those coordinates over there. That, too, we can view equivalently as an active map. We can say what's really going on here is that we mapped F into a point T with the diffeomorphism gamma. And we are looking at this action here under from the point of view of one chart alpha. So we keep alpha, and instead of saying that we have another chart, we can say it's the same chart alpha, and prepending is we do this diffeomorphism. It's easy to do. Simply, we concatenate gamma and alpha to obtain beta. So we say that beta is alpha after gamma. This is only to say we can go forward and backward. It's passive or active, all the same. Which also means that when we looked at Lie derivatives, we can view them active or passively. Actively or passively, the Lie derivative is telling us the change of a tensor T under the flow induced, the infinitesimal change of a tensor T under the flow induced by a vector field psi. And that flow we can view as an active map that maps points of the manifold into points of the manifold, or we can view it as leaving the points of the manifold where they are, but looking at them on a in a different coordinate system. We will later refer to that a little bit. Okay, so the intuition that we are pursuing here is this, that if we're given a differentiable manifold with a metric tensor given on it, some matrix valued function G mu nu of x, and the same differentiable manifold, but now we have a matrix valued function G prime mu nu of x, then if they are related by an isometric diffeomorphism, then really we are describing the same manifold in two different coordinate systems. It clearly has the same shape. Or if it were embedded, you could think of it as being rotated in the embedding or whatever. What that means is that there's going to be a whole lot of pairs, M and G, that describe exactly the same space-time. They describe exactly the same curved object. And we should consider all of those pairs, MG, differentiable manifold with a metric tensor on it, as being physically equivalent. We have to bunch them in one equivalence class if they're related by an isometric diffeomorphism. So we define that a pseudo-Riemannian structure, which we may call chi, like this, I hope this is what the Greeks would call chi. A pseudo-Riemannian structure is an equivalent class of all those Pseudo-Riemannian manifolds which can be mapped into each other via metric preserving diffeomorphisms. That is to say, via changes of coordinates. So if you are given a differentiable manifold and a metric tensor on it, it generates for you an entire equivalence class of differentiable manifolds with metric tensors on them that all describe the same object, the same physical object, the same thing with the same shape. These things, this forming of an equivalence class is easier said than done. And this is one of the key problems of quantum gravity. And the reason is that space-time ultimately will need to be modeled as a pseudo-Riemannian structure. It will need to be modeled as such an equivalence class of pairs of metric and differentiable manifold, not as just a metric and a differentiable manifold. No, it's a whole equivalence class of them. Because ultimately, we are not interested in which particular differentiable manifold with which particular metric tensor we choose to represent our space-time. It doesn't matter which g mu nu of x we choose. Ultimately, it's only the equivalence class of them that matters for the physics of it. The choice of coordinate system doesn't matter. The physics is coordinate system independent. And the key problem is that these equivalence classes are hard to handle. And that's because if somebody gives you one g mu nu of x and another g prime mu nu of x, then they might describe the same manifold or they might not, depending on whether there is a change of coordinates that gets you from the one to the other. But how do you find out? How do you scan through all possible changes of coordinates? It's not a practical thing to do. Clearly, you can generate such an equivalence class. If you're given a metric tensor, then you can always change coordinates and generate another one that describes exactly the same Riemannian structure. Right? You can keep changing coordinates, and then you get different representations for your manifold in this way. But if you're given two metrics, how do you find out whether or not there exists a diffeomorphism in between them? That's a tough problem. So what would be very desirable is to identify exactly one representative, MG, one of those pairs, per equivalence class. This is what would be called a fixing of gauge. Changing coordinate system, changing pair MG within one equivalence class is called gauging. And if you choose one representative out of each equivalence class, then that's what would be called fixing of a gauge. Concretely, why would that be useful? Mm-hmm. Yep.
In quantum mechanics, we quantize X and P to become operators. And we can perform canonical transformations on those things. So we really don't care about particular X and P. We care about the some sort of equivalent class of them, but we never really have to worry about that. Why do we have to worry about it here?
In quantum mechanics, the problem also occurs, but not just with the individual X and P's. In fact, in quantum mechanics too, you're right, you can do canonical transformations, which is, you know, classically the transformations that preserve the Poisson bracket, and quantum mechanically they have to preserve commutators, so they are unitary transformations. But remember that when you do such a canonical transformation, this is changing the physics. For example, you can choose a canonical transformation which turns the x's into p's and p's into x's. And certainly position is not momentum. So it changes the physics, it makes a difference, and therefore by choosing your experiment and identifying this operator describes position, that operator describes momentum, you are implicitly fixing a gauge at that moment. You're implicitly fixing what you have to work with. It makes a physical difference. But in quantum mechanics, it does happen as well, especially, well, the first time it happens is in electromagnetism, where you have actual, I mean, what is known as gauge degrees of freedom. And so you have to fix the gauge. And it's mathematically very similar to the case of gravity, just that in the case of electromagnetism, the mathematics is much simpler. And it is almost straightforward to fix a gauge such that from each gauge equivalence class, you draw just one representative. It's just that in gravity, it's much harder. And that's because the elements of a gauge equivalence class in electromagnetism are linearly related to each other. In general relativity, they are highly non-linearly related to each other because they're related through diffeomorphism. And that just makes it much harder. So why would it be useful to fix a gauge in practice? Well, the most important example where it is useful is in quantum gravity. So remember, we discussed describing shape through deficiency angles defect angles, through non-trivial metric distances, through non-trivial parallel transport. But you know, the G's are ambiguous, as we just saw. We have to put them in equivalence classes, and the same is true with the gammas, and there's an analog for deficiency angles. And now, remember how that, see how this happened, this leads to a problem in quantum gravity. Remember that quantum theory can be formulated in the path integral form. I hope that everybody has seen the path integral before, or a path integral before. If you have not and you have questions about it, see me after class. Okay, so quantum mechanics in the path integral formalism. If we apply naively the path integral formalism to gravity, we should expect that we have to handle path integrals of this form. Why of this form? Well, the path integral says, you know, integrate over all possibilities. And what are all the possibilities in gravity? Well, all the possibilities are all possible shapes that the space-time might have. But remember, a shape is a Riemannian structure. It's not a manifold with a metric. It's a Riemannian structure, the equivalence class, right? So every shape is given by an equivalence class of metrics that differ by changes of coordinates, right? And so the path integral should be over the different, over the physically different configurations. So the path integral should be integrating over all the Riemannian structures, not over all metrics, but over all Riemannian structures. So it should be, the path integral should be, we should be expecting to encounter path integrals of that form. We take some sort of action that we can calculate for every shape that space or space-time might take. And then we create a Feynman phase out of that, Feynman probability amplitude, and we have to sum over all of them. But it's the sum over all actual shapes, and therefore over all equivalence classes of mathematically equivalent description. But what we can actually write down is more like this. We can write down something like a path integral over all matrix-valued g mu nus of x. And then we calculate the phase like that. This would be the gravitational action here, integral over all g. But then we have to put in something that, you know, you have to view this as being in quotation marks here, some sort of delta function that singles out from all the equivalent g's that we will sum over here, just one per gauge equivalence class. And similarly, we could try to do that with the gammas. Sorry, this is the typo here. This should be a gamma in here. So we are summing over all the gammas, gravitational action. But again, if we sum over all gammas, we are summing over many of them that are really describing the same thing. We should be taking only one representative out of each gauge equivalence class. And a lot of the troubles in general relativity's quantization arise from not quite knowing how to handle this piece here, because that's what we want. This is what we get. So how do we extract the actual shape degrees of freedom from the degrees of freedom that we work with, like the G and the gamma, like the metric and the affine connection? Some authors have therefore suggested that maybe the G's and the gammas are both not the right thing to work with. Instead, we should work with quantities that can be calculated from them, but are more amenable to quantization because that problem is easier to handle. So for example, Ashtekar and others came up with so-called loop quantum gravity, where the idea is you use variables other than those for example, the frame fields, you know, the fields that diagonalize the metric so that it's at every point is simply the Itam Unni of special relativity. Those frame fields also contain all information about the shape. It's an alternative to describing the shapes of this or so that. And the idea is that those frame fields, together with their canonically conjugate momentum fields, could also be used for quantization of gravity. So you see, this is a key problem in general relativity's quantization. Now, I'd like to go off a bit on a tangent here and describe something about spectral geometry, which is a field that I'm personally working on quite a bit. And the motivation here is very similar to, is basically the motivation that I just explained. So the big question is, can one detect and describe a Riemannian, pseudo-Riemannian structure directly? How can we isolate the actual shape degrees of freedom? And an answer that I'm suggesting here is that spectral geometry might be used for that. The word, I should probably explain the word spectral geometry, even though a few lectures ago I mentioned it already. And the key idea behind this is the following. If you take a manifold and you view it as realized as some thin metal sheet, let's say if it's a two-dimensional manifold, we can do that. If it's higher dimensional, then of course it has to be something solid or even four-dimensional. But let's just for intuition think of a manifold as being two-dimensional, embedded in our R3, and it's realized as some thin metal sheet. Then clearly its vibration spectrum can be measured directly. Of course, abstractly, we would just look at the Laplace operator and its spectrum on the manifold. That is, as I will show a little later, that is showing up as the vibration spectrum if you actually realize it in nature or in the lab. Then the vibration spectrum will depend on the shape of the manifold, right? So the overtones that you hear when you take a spoon to a metal vase or something like this, the overtones that you hear will depend on the shape of the vase. And the key thing is that the overtones will not depend on any choice of coordinate system that you might use. The overtones have no idea about coordinate systems. The overtones just care about the shape, which is to say that the overtone spectrum, the frequencies lambda n that you can hear, will be a function only of the Riemannian structure, not of the particular metric G mu of x. It doesn't depend on coordinate systems. So clearly, those guys carry information that is purely about the shape and not about anything else that is human-made. In fact, spectral geometry is older than quantum theory. The idea that the spectrum of an object might encode its shape goes back to 1911, when Hermann Weyl proposed it. So then, the question is, does the spectrum encode perhaps all about the shape of the Riemannian structure? It clearly is affected by the shape, but does it know all about the shape? Now, it turns out that it doesn't contain all about the shape. At least in dimensions larger than 2, there are counterexamples known. So that would seem to be very off-putting, right? You have a conjecture, and then there are counterexamples. So we might as well forget about the conjecture, right? Okay, so now at this point, I'd like to go a little unconventional. I have here the rest of the lecture prepared. It goes for another 20 pages, and it's pretty technical. And what I'm calculating here is exactly the spectra, certain important properties that the Laplace operators on Riemannian manifolds have. Basically, the overtone spectrum, properties of this overtone spectrum. What is the overtone spectrum for a scalar wave? What is the overtone spectrum for a vector wave? what is the overtone spectrum for a p-form wave? Right? We have Laplacians, if you remember, we have Laplace operators that act on general p-forms. And it turns out that those spectra are very much interrelated. If you have, they're not the same, but they're interrelated. And these interrelations between the spectra is being worked out in the remainder of this lecture today. But it's pretty tedious. And so what I thought is, you have all the machinery. You can follow that mathematics. And I would like to make that assigned reading, that you read it on your own. And instead, I thought I'd give you a talk that I gave recently at a conference, which is motivating all of this and tells you more about the deeper reasons for why spectral geometry might be a good idea and how it all hangs together. And then for more mathematical details, you can always find the lectures. But otherwise, I'm afraid you would go through, you know, 20 pages of pretty tedious calculations of spectra. And then at the end, you might not know, why are we doing this? So I thought I switch now to a talk that I gave at a conference in Banff. In fact, that was why, for 1 week, I wasn't able to teach, because I was at that workshop and I was one of the organizers, so I really had to be there. And so you get the benefit of that lecture there. I've put it online for you to download as the lecture 11b. However, 11b contains two little movie clips, which together weigh something like 100 megabytes. So therefore, I haven't included those. If you want them, you know, I can give them to you somehow via Dropbox or whatever. But I didn't want to put 100 megabytes of movie clips there. They are so big because when we generated them with MATLAB, it was just not done for efficiency, but just to get the output somehow. We'll have to compress this thing at some point. OK, so this is the view this as a supplement to the lecture. And you will see that the style is completely different. Now, it's not going to be at all like the lecture, because this was meant as a talk for people who haven't just that moment studied differential geometry and GR. But it's going to contain also a little bit of quantum theory. But I will isolate what that is and explain that, hopefully, clearly. Some of you may already be familiar with this part of quantum theory. But if not, I'll explain it as we get there. So the key thing here is to motivate why spectral geometry might be a good idea in quantum gravity. OK, so we change gears. Different kind of talk now. So quantum gravity, the big unknown theory out there, is very difficult. But one thing we can tell about it already, which is that once it's found, we will find that it contains some sort of mathematical bridge between the languages of general relativity, the differential geometry that we've studied this term so far, and quantum theory. It will somehow have to bridge the two mathematically, independently of what the physics is going to be. Since it's going to unite the two physical disciplines, it will have to unite the two mathematical languages too. Now, differential geometry is all about metrics, affine connections, curvatures, tensors, and so on. And functional analysis, the mathematical language of quantum theory, on the other hand, is about totally different things. It's about spectra, about entanglement, about Hilbert spaces. And there seems to be virtually no overlap between the mathematical language here and the mathematical language over there. So what could possibly bridge the two? So here's spectral geometry. Spectral geometry could bridge between those two mathematical languages. So as we already discussed, the big question in spectral geometry is, how far is shape determined by sound? Take a vase and hit on it with a spoon, just lightly, and it will vibrate and you might record the overtone spectrum. Let's not care about the amplitude of the overtones, just the frequencies of the overtones. Just what frequencies are excited. Remember, this is going to have lots of eigenwaves, eigenvectors too, but we are not caring about the eigenvectors, just the eigenfrequencies. With what frequencies will it vibrate? This is an actual recording of a vibrating object. And you will see lots of harmonics here. These are the usual, often you get harmonic overtones, which are roughly equidistantly spaced there. Now, it's clear that if the shape of the vase is different, the overtone spectrum will be different too. And the question is, how do the frequencies of the vibration reflect the shape? To what extent do they capture the shape? Now, the shape is technically for us a Riemannian structure. It's an equivalence class of differentiable manifolds with a metric tensor on it that consists of those that are related by an isometric diffeomorphism. On the other hand, this side here, this is about spectra. The overtone spectrum is just a list of frequencies. See, this should be sharp spikes, completely sharp. The reason why they are not completely sharp is simply that there's dissipation and internal friction, stuff goes into heat, and this will widen the frequency spikes. In principle, they are, it's just a sharp list of frequencies that are the overtone spectrum of the object. And you see, a spectrum is something that is in the language of quantum mechanics, eigenvalues of an operator. So if we can relate shape to spectrum, we are relating differential geometry to functional analysis. And that could be something, or should be something, that arises in quantum gravity as well. Now, there are already some positive results in that respect, in particular for objects that are objects of revolution, that have a symmetry axis, and so they're much simpler, and there are positive results that show that you can actually get their shape out of their sound. Actually, I think it's in the flat case, not in the case of its embedded, where they have shown that explicitly. So this leads to a beautiful prospect. If only we can map the vases to their sound, or the sound to the vases, really, then maybe we can push it all the way to 3+1 dimensions, where the curvature of the vase is now the curvature of space-time. Here you see Einstein rings. You know, you can see here, literally, with your own eyes, that space-time is curved, because the heavy masses of these galaxies here are curving space to the extent that light sources behind those heavy galaxies, which are galaxies themselves, are no longer point-like, but instead they are drawn out to become those pieces of rings there. It's just like when your eyes have astigmatism, then a point source becomes sort of an extended object. Here it is as if space-time itself has astigmatism. On the other hand, so this is the curvature business. On the other hand, we can measure the quantum noise of even empty space. If you take an empty box and you cool it down to close to zero, then there is absolutely nothing in there, no light, no particles. If you use a detector to detect light, you can actually still detect light in there, because the electromagnetic field will fluctuate. And the so-called homodyne detector in quantum optics, a thing you can easily build, every quantum optics lab builds these things nowadays, With such a detector, you can measure directly the quantum fluctuations of the electromagnetic field in the dark. So what I'm saying is that space-time doesn't need a spoon. The vase, in order to start to ring, needs a spoon to click on it, right? Space-time doesn't, because there's always quantum fluctuations. It ought to always ring a little bit. So in principle, with a homodyne detector, you could listen to the noise that is always there on space-time, even when there's no matter. There's always some noise. And in principle, we should be able to detect from that noise what the overtone spectrum is of our space-time. And from that overtone spectrum, if spectral geometry works, we should be able to determine what the curvature is. Now, that's not meant to be a practical method. If you want to measure the curvature out there in space, you better get a telescope and just check pictures like this. But in principle, you could measure the vacuum fluctuations and then listen to the vacuum fluctuations at different places, work out what the ringing of space-time is, work out what the overtone spectrum is, and from that overtone spectrum, using spectral geometry, in principle, if spectral geometry works, should be able to work out what its curvature is as well. Of course, the sensitivity is nowhere near close to what you would get with a telescope. But as a matter of principle, the ringing of space-time, its overtone spectrum, could encode the curvature. Clearly, the curvature will affect the ringing, but will it affect it enough so that the ringing has all the information about the curvature? That's the big question here. So the big problem, as we discussed just a few minutes ago, is that spectral geometry has counterexamples. Okay, so there are, at least for dimension larger than 2, examples of curved spaces, for example, certain high-dimensional tori, which are not isometric, but they sound the same. They have just the same spectrum. In higher dimensions, there are even several parameter families of differential manifolds or Riemannian manifolds which have the same spectrum, but they are not isometric to each other. At that point, we should probably say, well, OK, nice idea, but doesn't work. Okay, doesn't work. And in fact, why should it work? Why would we ever think that a spectrum could have enough information? I mean, it's just Weyl's idea of like 102 years ago that maybe it has it. But do we have any reason to believe why the spectrum should contain everything, all the information about the shape? Are we dreaming about this? Okay, so in order to pursue our goal to bring gravity into a shape, that the formulation of gravity into a shape that would facilitate quantization, in order to describe gravity in terms that are more in the language of quantum theory, in terms of spectra, for example, it seems that we have to start over, because we seem to have arrived here at a dead end. So let's start over again. Let's try a new idea, which goes back to Einstein, who credits Helmholtz, but actually it probably goes back to Gauss. Right? In fact, it does go back to Gauss. And the idea is an idea that we have already discussed, but we will take it in a new direction. So the basic idea is that curvature of space, or curvature of anything, is encoded in the mutual distances. Okay. That idea took us in the direction of defining the metric tensor. And then from there, we can define everything else, like the Riemann curvature tensor and so on. But now, let us start with this idea that curvature is encoded in mutual distances and take it in a different direction that leads us to spectral geometry again, in a way that we can then fix spectral geometry and make it work. And the key point is this, that curvature is clearly encodable in the mutual distances, but the distances between two points can be encoded in entanglement. Remember that at every point in space, fields are fluctuating. For example, the electromagnetic field. At this point, at this moment now, it's fluctuating a little bit. If you had a homodyne detector, you could measure that. It's fluctuating a little bit. Take a neighboring point. There, too, the electromagnetic field is fluctuating in its amplitude a little bit. The two sets of fluctuations are actually not independent of each other. They are a little bit correlated. The further away the two points are that I'm considering, the less are the quantum fluctuations correlated. If the two points are very close together, then they are going to be very strongly correlated, the fluctuations. This means that I can measure the distance between two points by measuring how correlated their quantum fluctuations are. The quantum fluctuations of the fields are at those two points. But you see, this is an important step now. Because instead of measuring distances simply with a ruler, we can measure distances by measuring correlations of quantum fluctuations. Point being that the distances encode curvature, and the quantum fluctuations, their correlations, is a purely quantum phenomenon. So we're relating general relativity to a language that is purely quantum. For now, spatial distances. Yes.
Would it work also for space-time distances?
I would say probably, but it hasn't been worked out yet. There is a lot of work to be done. Maybe you do it. Okay, so this opens up a beautiful prospect. Namely, space-time curvature is expressible in... I should explain that more deeply here. I think I should explain to you a little bit more about quantum fluctuations in a crystal, because that's very similar to quantum fluctuations in vacuum. Oh, there's a question. Yes.
I just don't know what you mean by mutual.
Oh, the distance between two points. Okay. Yeah, the word mutual is just that. You know, the distance from A to B is the same as from B to A. Nothing deep. The word mutual didn't have any, nothing to do with mutual information or something. No. Okay, so imagine, consider a crystal, then consider the nuclei of the atoms in the crystal. Those nuclei are sitting at the bottom of a well. Okay, if you displace one of the nuclei in a crystal, it will want to go right back to where its equilibrium position is. So the position of any one of those nuclei is pretty much fixed, right? They are sitting in a regular lattice. And they are fluctuating harmonically around the equilibrium position. Now, those harmonic oscillators are coupled to each other. One nucleus, if I displace it, will actually bother the neighboring nuclei. So those harmonic oscillators are as if they are independent harmonic oscillators almost, but they are coupled with springs to each other, right? So you can kick one of the nuclei and it will lead to a wave that propagates through the whole crystal. Phonons are just that. Okay, so the point is that you have a lot of coupled harmonic oscillators there. Now remember that coupled harmonic oscillators will have a ground state which is not simply the tensor product between the ground states of the individual harmonic oscillators, but instead the ground state will be a slightly entangled state. That's why the quantum fluctuations that a nucleus has around its equilibrium position will be correlated to the quantum fluctuations that a neighboring nucleus will have around its equilibrium position. Right? So we have local harmonic oscillators that are coupled to each other. And so in a ground state, there will be correlations between the fluctuations here and the fluctuations there. In space-time, it's a similar situation, only that the local oscillators are simply the field amplitude. A field can oscillate locally. Its amplitude can oscillate locally. And it will couple to the field at neighboring positions. That is why fields describe propagating waves. Because if you excite a field here, then you're not only exciting the oscillator here, that oscillator will also excite the neighboring oscillators, and so wave will propagate. So that's why you have correlations in the quantum fluctuations of fields. Now, what happens if you take your crystal and you deform it? You have a big crystal there. And let's say you're a giant and you can deform the crystal with your bare hands, okay? So what will happen is then that the equilibrium positions of your nuclei will now be a little bit different because you've actually deformed the crystal a little bit. They will now oscillate around different positions. Some distances will have changed between the nuclei. It is as if you have given this thing some curvature, right? So parallel transport wouldn't be trivial anymore because the whole crystal is now deformed a little bit. That means that the oscillations will be coupled slightly differently and the quantum fluctuations will be correlated slightly differently. Same deal happens in space-time, whereas, you know, this idea goes back to the late 60s, Andrei Sakharov, where in space-time too, the quantum fluctuations of the vacuum, quantum fluctuations of fields in the vacuum, are affected by curvature in space-time. So what I'm saying here is that when space-time has curvature, then this leads to a non-trivial change of the coupling between the local field oscillators. Waves propagate differently in a curved space than they propagate on a flat space. So the coupling of the harmonic oscillator that sits at each point, in space are a little bit affected by the curvature. And that means that the vacuum entanglement will be affected. And therefore, curvature manifests itself not only in non-triviality of Pythagoras, or violating of Pythagoras, not only in the sum of the angles not adding up to 180 degrees in a triangle. It not only manifests itself in non-triviality of parallel transport. No, curvature also manifests itself in the non-triviality of the quantum vacuum fluctuations, correlations over various distances. And the beautiful prospect is that the quantum vacuum fluctuations know everything about the space-time, all of the curvature. But do they? Yes?
Entanglement is a notion which is relative to your factorization of the Hilbert space.
Yes.
Right?
And in this case, the factorization is that you split the Hilbert space into a part that describes one region in space or another region in space.
So are we forced into some sort of operational?
It's just spatial, So you have observables in this region, observables in that region, and their quantum fluctuations are going to be correlated more than classically. So that's what allows us to say that it's entanglement. Okay, but does the change in the quantum fluctuations really encode the curvature? Let's see. Okay, let's start very basically, completely from scratch. Imagine a museum dinosaur, okay, big museum, it has this dinosaur. And you're given the task of capturing its shape. So you sprinkle the dinosaur with a lot of points, let's say capital N points, and you're recording the distances between any pair of points on the dinosaur. So after a long day of work, you will get a matrix, an n by n matrix of the distances between any two points. Of course, that doesn't mean that you have to do n squared measurements because it's a symmetric matrix, right? Now, let's say the next day or in that night, the museum burns down. The dinosaur is gone. But you stored your n by n matrix in the cloud. So you still have that. Now, can you reconstruct the shape of the dinosaur? Well, in principle, you should be able to do it. Because if you took your n by n matrix and you tried to reconstruct an elephant, you probably wouldn't succeed. You don't get that set of distances from an elephant. It's got to be the dinosaur. Okay, so we should be able to get some sort of scaffolding. Of course, you won't get exactly the dinosaur, because you haven't used infinitely many points. But if you've used points with an average distance of, let's say, a centimeter, you should be getting a resolution down to about a centimeter of your dinosaur. Now, that would be a completely classical way of capturing curvature. It's sort of like recording the metric tensor. You know, it's, you're recording just small distances all over the place. But let's do the quantum version of that. And surprisingly, this will lead us back to spectral geometry. So let's try to get length from entanglement. So we capture the shape of the dinosaur by capturing those lengths. But the vacuum entanglement, as we discussed, decays with distance. So if we take two points of the dinosaur, and you measure the quantum fluctuations here, and the quantum fluctuations over there, and you measure the correlator between them, the correlator will get the smaller the further away the two points are, and the larger the closer the two points are. It's a measure of distance. So therefore, what we can do is we can, instead of measuring the distances between any two points on the sprinkling, let us measure the two-point correlation function. So here's the field amplitude at the point xn, and that is the field amplitude at the point xm, which is somewhere else there. And we calculate the expectation value of the product of the two. This is, statistically speaking, the correlator. We can go out there and measure that in principle. And that will give us an n by n matrix, not directly of distances, but of these correlators. And they have a property just like the distances. They're monotonic with the distance. So let's say one day you do that. And let's say the evening, a fire, museum burns down, dinosaur is gone, but you have that matrix. You have that n by n matrix of the correlator. Can you reconstruct what the shape is? It's the same story as with the length. You won't be able to make an elephant out of this. It will only, in general, fit together if it's what you started with. Because it's such an over-constrained system there. So now we have captured the shape, the curvature of it, or really the Riemannian structure of it. We have captured the shape of it in terms of this n by n matrix, which is now completely in terms of quantum terms. It's the vacuum expectation value of the product of two fields. The field amplitudes here, the field amplitudes there, the correlator, two-point function. So that would mean that we can then encode curvature in terms of entanglement, for example, on the quantum computer. So on curved space, on the side of the curved space, we would have n points on, let's say, the dinosaur. And we measure the mutual entanglement, or more precisely, we measure the two-point function. It doesn't have to be measurement as in instrumentation. It could also be, you know, just recording on paper, just a theoretical exercise. On the side of the quantum computer, we would model the n points on the dinosaur as n qubits or qdits in the quantum computer, which don't have to be in any particular spatial arrangement. The point is that we measure on the dinosaur what the mutual entanglement, or what the two-point function is, between any two such points. And then we recreate that in the quantum computer by arranging a state in which the n qdits, which stand for the n points on the skin of the dinosaur, have the same entanglement as over there on the dinosaur. So we have an entanglement representation in the quantum computer of the shape that the dinosaur has. So in this way, a quantum computer could learn to represent a curved object, such as curved space-time or curved space. However, it seems at first that all of this has been in vain, because we set out to get a direct representation of the degrees of freedom of shape, right? We didn't want to fall into the same trap as with the metric and with the affine connection. The metric and the affine connection depend on the choice of coordinate system. It's very hard to get to the bottom of it and find out what information in this matrix valued function g mu nu of x encodes really the shape of the space-time, and what information in g mu nu of x encodes just the choice of coordinate system, right? Because obviously, the g mu nu of x matrix function will change if I change the shape of the manifold, but it also changes if I change coordinate system. How do I distinguish the two kinds of degrees of freedom? Because only one of them needs to be quantized, not the other. And here it seems we have a very similar problem again. We again have redundant information in our matrix G. And that's because the entries of our matrix G very much depend on where we chose to sprinkle points on the dinosaur. Right? Very much depends on that. But this is unsatisfactory. If we chose different points on our dinosaur, then we would get different two-point correlators. We would get a different matrix. But it would be the same dinosaur. So we need somehow to distill the shape information of the dinosaur out of that matrix G. Similarly, to the challenge to distill the shape information out of G mu nu of x, or out of the Christoffel symbols of x. So it would seem that we are stuck again. We have an excessively redundant representation of the shape of the space-time. However, it turns out we can do much better. It is, in fact, possible to distill the information out of G. And here is how that can be done. Remember that our n by n matrix is given by the vacuum expectation value of the correlator. And this, as it turns out, and you just have to believe that for the moment, this is a standard result of quantum field theory, namely that the two-point function is given by the inverse of the differential operator in the action. This is the Green's function. This is simply the propagator. So if you apply the Laplace plus m squared onto the Green's function, you get the delta function, the covariant delta function. This has a square root of g factor in it. My point is, our n by n matrix that encodes the dinosaur in the museum is actually matrix elements of this differential operator, where m is the mass of the particles for the field that we are considering here. You can choose the m to be 0 if you like. In other words, we have here the Laplace operator occurring. And what we see is that the n by n matrix that encodes the shape of our museum dinosaur is really equal to, according to standard results of quantum field theory, equal to to 1 over the Laplacian evaluated at the two points on the dinosaur in question, points xn and xm. Our n by n matrix that encodes the shape of the dinosaur is simply matrix elements of this operator in this basis, in this position basis. And now we see what it means to change the sprinkling of points on our dinosaur. If we change to a different sprinkling, if we choose our points at different locations on the dinosaur, then we are changing the positions xn, xm, where we record the correlator. So we are changing the basis in which the basis vectors in which we evaluate 1 over the Laplacian. In other words, this is always 1 over the Laplacian, just in different bases. And the sprinkling independent shape, purely shape information, is therefore basis independent information. But we do know what the basis independent information of an operator is. It's its spectrum. So what we arrive at here is, while again, we now have a good reason to believe that the spectrum of the Laplace operator encodes the shape of the dinosaur. because the spectrum of the Laplace operator is the basis independent information in it, and therefore it's the sprinkling independent information in our matrix G here. Yeah, classically you would have a problem here, because if there are two geodesics, then which one do you choose? There's both sort of shortest distance, right? But here we're not working with geodesics. We abandoned the actual distance. We are simply calculating what the strength of the correlator is. So that's just, you know, quantum mechanics takes care of that. There is no particular path taken in between them. You simply measure the quantum fluctuations here, quantum fluctuations there, product of the two vacuum expectation value.
When you say that you consider two points really close together, yeah, to find the strongly correlated, as they get farther apart,
yes, that's right.
So it somehow encodes the distance.
Well, that is right. But remember, we no longer need distances. We go from that, from this, directly to the shape. You never need to know about distances at all. One day in the museum, this is the matrix that you record. Then the museum burns down. And the next day, you go about building something, and you play around with the shapes until you get a shape that you measure again that. And then you have your dinosaur again. And never in this process did you ever need a ruler to measure distances. Never do. Because the only thing you ever measure is correlators of quantum fluctuations between two points. The notion of distance doesn't come up anymore. It's replaced by the notion of strength of correlation.
You should be able to recover the classical stuff from this.
Right? Well, that's right. Ultimately, you get your dinosaur back. And then you can go about measuring with the ruler. But the point is that from measurement to reconstruction, you don't need the ruler. Later, you get back your dinosaur, and you can go about measuring it out with the ruler. Right, so the distillation of the shape information works now this way. The sprinkling independent information in our matrix G, our n by n matrix G, is basis independent information in G. And so it's the basis independent information contained in that operator. But this basis independent information will be the spectrum of the operator. Now the spectrum of this operator immediately tells us the spectrum of the Laplacian itself, because the Laplacian is diagonal in the same basis as is the entire operator over here, right? Because this is just m squared times the identity. So to know the spectrum of this operator is to know the spectrum of the Laplace operator. So the spectrum of the Laplace operator contains sprinkling invariant information of G. So in a new way, we arrived at the central conjecture of spectral geometry. We now have a reason to think that the spectrum should contain the information about the shape. However, there were counterexamples. At some point, we must have lost information. Where did that happen? Let's step back a little bit. When we distilled shape information, how did we argue? We said that, OK, this thing contains the information about the dinosaur. And then we said that if we change sprinkling, we are changing those xn. We are changing those positions. So changing the sprinkling is changing bases in the function space on which this operator acts. But while all changes of sprinkling are changes of bases, it's not true that all changes of bases are changes of sprinkling. Because I could go from the basis of the xn to a different basis that is not a position eigenbasis at all. That is, I don't know, the eigenbasis of the Laplacian, for example. So therefore, we have to be careful here. It is true that all changes of sprinkling are changes of bases, but not all changes of bases are changes of sprinkling. But the sprinkling independent information in G is only the sprinkling independent information. That's not necessarily the same as the basis independent information. The basis independent information in G is less than just the sprinkling independent information of G. So there can be curvature information in G that we've thrown out by just looking at the spectrum. And this appears to have happened here. So should we give up again? I mean, we seem to be so close. On one hand, we found a good reason to think that Weyl was right all along. Weyl had, in 1911, already the right idea, because it's so close, right? It's so good motivation we have for it. But then, how can we fix this? So let's try to fix spectral geometry then. A fresh start for spectral geometry. How can we recover all of the information in a constructive way? We are not happy with just, you know, in principle proofs of existence and stuff. We want to actually be able to do it. Get from the sound to the shape. This is what the two movies are going to be about, because we actually did it. Okay, so a fresh start for spectral geometry. We start with the observation that spectral geometry is hard because it's highly nonlinear. If you calculate the spectrum of the Laplace operator on a curved Riemannian manifold, very difficult job to do, very nonlinear. From the G mu of x to go to the lambda of the eigenvalues of the Laplace operator, very nonlinear problem, very hard to invert that. Very hard, therefore, to go from the spectrum back to the metric. Nobody can do this. Only in very, very highly symmetric cases where you have very few parameters can you do that. But that's not the case of interest, because space-time has no symmetries whatsoever. We need the generic case. So the idea then is, for a fresh start for spectral geometry, try infinitesimal spectral geometry. So imagine, I mean, the full problem of spectral geometry is this. Somebody gives you the sound of a vase, and then you're supposed to calculate how that vase looks like. Very hard problem. But imagine you're given a much simpler task. You already have the vase and its sound. You know both of them. And then somebody tells you, wait a moment, the sound has changed a little bit. It's now this sound, just a little bit changed. Can you tell me how the shape changed? Okay, a small change of shape will trigger a small change of sound. Can you calculate from the small change of sound what the small change of shape is? See, this is way easier because it's linear. It's just a small perturbation of shape and a small perturbation of sound. And there ought to be a linear map in between them. If we can calculate from small sound changes what the small shape changes are, then we can iterate that process. And we go, always small changes, small changes, small changes, and we can build up to big changes, and we can even get, you know, big shape differences from big sound differences. That's the overall idea. You see, in pure mathematics, they have studied spectral geometry for 100 years, but they haven't done perturbation theory, because that's a physicist thing. Mathematicians want to prove or not prove something. But here we go about doing stuff perturbatively. That's new. Okay, so we assume we are given a manifold and its spectrum, we perturb infinitesimally, and then we calculate the change of shape from the change of spectrum using the fact that they're going to be linearly related. And here's how it goes, pretty simple. We describe a small change of shape on the manifold through a function, scalar function f, which lives on the manifold. So our function f could be describing a small bump on the manifold, let's say. Right? So let's say we have a vase, and then on that vase, we want now to grow a little bump. How do we do that? Well, we put a function on the manifold, and if it's positive, a little bit positive, then it will the vase will grow a little bump outwards. If it's negative, it will grow a little dent inwards, let's say. So we can describe a small change of shape of our vase through a function f in this way. Now, the function f can be expanded in the eigenbasis of the Laplacian on our manifold. The Laplacian, if you remember, is a self-adjoint operator. It has an eigenspectrum, and it has eigenfunctions. And we're expanding now our function f in terms of the eigenbasis of the Laplacian. So it's easy. The function f, which describes a small change of shape, is the linear combination of some coefficients times the eigenfunctions of the Laplacian. While we change the shape, the Laplacian changes. And with perturbation theory, just exactly the same mathematical perturbation theory that you use in quantum mechanics to check how the spectrum of a Hamiltonian of a Schrödinger problem is changing as you change the potential. Here, too, you can calculate how the spectrum of the Laplace operator changes as you change the shape of the manifold, because you're changing the Laplace operator. It's just like, you know, in quantum mechanics, you have the Hamiltonian, which is Laplacian over 2m minus Laplacian over 2m plus potential, right? If you change the potential a little bit, it will affect the spectrum, and you calculate that with perturbation theory. Here you have the Laplacian itself changing a little bit because of the change of shape. And it's exactly the same method to calculate the change of spectrum while you do that. So the change of spectrum is such that every eigenvalue lambda n goes into lambda n plus a small perturbation. So remember, we had the coefficients little fn, which described the change of shape. And here we have little coefficients mu n, which describe the change of sound. We do know that small changes of shape will determine a small change of sound. There is going to be a matrix that relates them linearly, okay? Just because we are looking at basically a Taylor expansion. That's the Taylor expansion's linear coefficient here. So small change of shape triggers small change of sound. The big question is S invertible? If it is invertible, we can calculate from small change of sound what the small change of shape is, and then integrate that up to get the shape from the sound. For that purpose, let's assume that our eyesight is not perfect, and our hearing is also not perfect. So we can only see and hear stuff up to the first n eigenvalues, eigenvectors of the Laplacian. See, the high eigenvalues correspond to very high frequencies, and the eigenfunctions to very small wavelengths. So we don't see extremely small wavelengths. We don't hear extremely high frequencies. In practice, that would be the Planck scale, for example. So we assume here a cutoff in nature, or at least in mathematics. So we consider the first n eigenfunctions and the first n eigenvalues of the Laplace operator. Finite vision, finite hearing. And then we can count degrees of freedom. It turns out that the number of eigenvalues is equal to the number of eigenfunctions, as is the custom in linear algebra, right? This is always the case. And therefore, we have as many coefficients that describe change of shape as we have coefficients that describe the change of sound, n of them, capital N of them. Therefore, the matrix S and M becomes a generic square matrix, which is generically invertible. The determinant of that matrix has no reason to be equal to zero. It turns out that when the manifold has no boundary, then both this set is reduced by 1 and that set is reduced by 1, but let's not get into that. It's in my papers. Anyway, so this matrix S that relates the small changes of sound to the small changes of shape becomes invertible in general. It's a generic square matrix. The determinant has no reason to be 0, so it ought to be possible to invert. But that means spectral geometry should work, at least infinitesimally. From small changes of sound, we should get small changes of shape. But then, doesn't that mean spectral geometry works after all? What about the counterexample? Somehow we seem to have overlooked something again. Because again, we find evidence it should work. It should really work. And then we know, wait, there are counterexamples. Can't work. So what did we overlook this time? What we missed is shear waves. Does anybody know what shear waves are? Imagine an earthquake happens. California, big thing happens. Then there will be different kinds of waves. There will be waves, pressure waves of that kind. You know, one layer of rock pressing onto the other layer of rock, and like that, the wave propagates. But there will also be waves of the twisting or shearing kind, where a rock will twist like this, and that will twist the neighboring layer of rock, and it will go like that. So basically, a twist, a rotation, will go through the rock. And a rotation, or just a sideways motion, instead of a longitudinal pressure wave, it could just be a sidewavy thing, right? And those vectors, waves are actually tensorial, and they are of a different nature, fundamentally of a different nature than the pressure waves. They propagate at a different velocity, and also they have different reflection properties. So, for example, the pressure waves will propagate through the crust of the Earth. They will go even into the liquid interior in the middle of the Earth. Whereas the shear waves cannot propagate in the liquid interior, because you can't shear a liquid. I mean, you can shear it, but it will not snap back. So the shear waves will actually reflect off the solid-liquid boundary. And this is how you can measure where it is. So the point is that shear waves carry different information than the pressure wave. And we've only looked at scalar waves so far, the analog of pressure waves. We haven't looked at shear waves. If the manifold also has the ability to carry shear waves, maybe we should look at them. Indeed, we made a big mistake when we described the perturbation of the shape of the manifold by a scalar function f. Remember, I said if it takes a positive value, then the vase will grow a bump outwards. If it takes a negative value, it will grow a dent inwards. Well, in two dimensions, that's fine. But in higher dimensions, curvature is really tensorial. And you can't just describe it by a scalar function. And a change of curvature is also not just scalar. It is a tensorial thing. So any perturbation of the shape has to be described by a tensor, not just by a scalar. So we described only very small changes of shape as a subset of changes of shape. That we were able to hear, but not all changes of shape. So what we really should do is, in order to fix spectral geometry, is we should consider the change of spectra, not just of scalar waves, but also of vector waves and of covariant symmetric two-tensor waves as well. In fact, covariant symmetric two-tensor waves can be decomposed into a part of scalar origin, a part of vector origin, they're part of truly tensor origin. Just like vector fields in electromagnetism can always be decomposed into a gradient field and a curl field, where the gradient field is of scalar origin because it's the gradient of a scalar function. Also, for a covariant symmetric two-tensor like the metric or metric perturbation, you can decompose that into a part that is of scalar origin, a part of vector origin, and a truly tensor part. If we do that, and we look at the wave equations for scalar vectors and tensor waves, we look at their spectra, their overtone spectra, the three spectra, then we can go through the same counting argument before with finite vision, finite hearing, and you'll find that there are as many degrees of freedom of shape change as there are degrees of freedom of sound change. And therefore, it should be possible. And in this case, there's no known counterexample in the literature, not one that I know about anyway. So overall, in quantum gravity, quantum gravity should contain a mathematical bridge between the languages of general relativity, differential geometry, and quantum theory, which is functional analysis. And spectral geometry is a candidate for bridging those two languages. And the conclusion is that we might be able to bridge between those two languages, however, only if in spectral geometry we use the spectra both of scalar one forms and of covariant symmetric two tensors. With two summer students, we worked it out, at least for two dimensions, because that's where we can nicely visualize it. This is Tejal, that is Dave. Tejal is from Mumbai, and Dave is from Vancouver. What you see here is not a dinosaur, it's more like a dinosaur egg. It's a very simple version here. And so we iterated infinitesimal inverse spectral geometry. So we generated a random shape calculated the spectrum that it has, and then gave the computer just the spectrum. And it was supposed to find that shape. And the way it did it was that it started with a random shape, and then in infinitesimals, or in small steps, adjusted the shape so that the spectrum became closer and closer to the target spectrum until it found the shape. And that actually worked out.
Not just the scalar spectrum.
But in two dimensions, the scalar spectrum actually suffices. Because in two dimensions, as we will see later in the course, in two dimensions, gravity really has only one scalar degree of freedom. In higher dimensions, it has more degrees of freedom. But in two dimensions, it should work with just one. One spectrum, and that's what we found. So, so what you see here is it will start with a random shape, and then it will adjust the shape in small steps until it reaches the target shape. And we verified it was really the target shape. So, but we, what we were given, what we gave the algorithm was only the target spectrum, and it found the target shape. I think this this movie will show two of those examples where it starts with a random shape and ends up with another random shape. So all you see is really a random shape changing into a random shape. Well, come on. Ah, there it is. See, that was target shape, and whoop, now this is the target shape. Okay, now that doesn't really capture the imagination perhaps, but here's another one. We started out with the sphere. The fact that it looks more like an ellipsoid is that it's just a matter of projection there, but it really was mathematically a sphere. So that was the starting shape that the algorithm was supposed to start with. And then we gave it the spectrum of a cube. And we said, now find what it is. And then it was, and then it ran and it finds the cube. All right. But you see, what needs to be done, of course, is to generalize that to three dimensions for space, and then eventually 3+1 dimensions for space and time. And ultimately, the idea here is to express a Riemannian structure directly in degrees of freedom that encode only the curvature, that only encode the shape, and are not dependent on anything human-made. So the eigenvalues, the spectrum. Because the eigenvalues are independent of the coordinate system in which you calculate them. There's a complete invariance of the manifold. And then if we could express the differential geometry in terms of eigenvalues, if we could express the shape of spacetime in terms of eigenvalues, the hope would be that the eigenvalues are much easier to quantize. I mean, they start out as eigenvalues. It's already in the language of quantum mechanics. All right, that was it. Just a sec, this was it for today. On Thursday, we will start with wave equations. I mean, we start basically with general relativity. So we will not do yet the dynamics of space-time, but we will do the dynamics of fields that live on space-time, and in particular, the Dirac equation on space-time. And then after we've done that, we go into general relativity proper and study the dynamics of general relativity. Okay, was it?